Welcome to Opportunity Rocks with your host, Rocky Bhatia. This podcast explores the dynamic world of finance and how it affects your business. Get ready for in-depth discussions on everything from taxation and compliance to emerging trends in the financial and insurance sectors. With over a decade of experience in both the Canadian and U.S. markets, we invite you to turn up the volume and get ready to rock with your host, Rocky Bhatia.
Welcome to another episode of Opportunity Rocks. I'm your host, Rocky Bhatia. I'm a partner at Baker Tilly. And with me today is our first external guest is Vance Langford of Langford Law. He is based out of Calgary and now recently acquired an office in Vancouver. Welcome, Vance.
Thank you, Rocky. It's a pleasure to be here.
I'm really excited to have you here and to learn more about your background. And I know all about it, but our listeners would be very interested. So maybe you could just quickly provide an introduction of yourself, of your firm, and what you do.
Thank you. Well, Langford Law was established in 2018 as a small law firm focusing on cross-border Canada and U.S. law. So we practice corporate, commercial, immigration, employment, and dispute resolution law. And most of what we do with you, Rocky, is the corporate and commercial law. So we're working with Canadian clients that are looking to go into the U.S. market. And the starting point for that is to get them tax advice and get correct and proper tax advice from a U.S. CPA. The U.S. CPA, someone like you, will advise on the appropriate structure for them in the U.S., and then we can incorporate, organize, and maintain their business entities, the U.S. business entities, here at our offices in Calgary and Vancouver at Canadian dollar rates. So you're really getting the benefit of a U.S. attorney here in Canada, local service, and you know the fee structure is significantly lower in Canadian dollars with our firm. So yes, Langford Law has grown from a handful of people to now about 20 people in two offices with a number of U.S. and Canadian attorneys practicing in those areas.
Well, thank you for that introduction, Vance. And we've known each other for a few years now, and it's great seeing your firm grow. And I totally understand the lower mainland kind of connection to the United States because it's attached. And very close to attached to Washington State and very close to Seattle and the West Coast market there. Now, just for our listeners, please explain the importance of being licensed both in Canada and the United States and how that helps you, you know, service your clients.
Well, the U.S. is a very broad jurisdiction, and it's also a complex jurisdiction because, for example, with corporate law, there is no federal corporate law. So each state has its own laws. And if you're going to practice corporate law in the United States, then you better know what you're doing. If you're practicing in any type of U.S. law, then you must be admitted to practice, licensed and insured to practice U.S. law. So a Canadian lawyer simply can't dabble in U.S. law for liability reasons. However, once you have that licensure and you're insured to practice U.S. law, then you know, you're able to learn, grow, and serve your clients while doing so based on knowledge and expertise without purporting to know all of the laws of every state in the United States. That's simply too much. So the way we practice it is we do know corporate law in a number of jurisdictions. We also do assist our clients with M&A or mergers and acquisitions and other types of law. But we're, you know, very careful to ensure that we understand local laws and have the backup of local counsel where it's appropriate.
Right, right. And that's where our kind of relationship kicked off is that, you know, your experience and expertise and licensing in the U.S. and Canada is very rare. And in particular, with respect to not only corporate law, but also immigration law. So maybe we can kind of go into some of the projects we've been working on over the last few years. We've done at least, I was counting at least a dozen projects. And it seems to be a theme that our typical client base is Canadian privately held company looking to expand into the United States. And that's been going on, you know, for a number of years. Generally speaking, the market is much more enticing in the United States just from a sheer volume and population size. It is often from our client base that they don't often seek to enter the United States. It's almost like they're pulled into the United States. They start off their business with a bit of success in Canada. And next thing you know, they attend a trade conference or something in the U.S. And now they're expanding into the U.S. and they don't even realize it. And often after a few successful years, our clients start to look at maybe setting up a U.S. corporation. So maybe if you could describe to me, we worked on this and we talked about this a bit. What's your kind of jurisdiction of preference when a company's looking to expand into the U.S. with a U.S. corporation? And what are some of the legal reasons for that?
Well, as you know, Rocky, we don't practice tax law and we don't give any tax advice. That's why our relationship with Baker Tilly works so well. We are able to advise our clients from the outset. We don't do tax. We can introduce you to great U.S. CPAs at Baker Tilly, and they'll do all of the tax advisory work and the compliance work ongoing. So when we start to consider, and it's just that we'll have a Canadian client that is looking at expanding into the larger market to the south. So they'll say, well, where should we go? And in terms of our general considerations, we'll want to know where you're going to be doing business. So, for example, if you're likely, you know, you're in Saskatchewan and you want to be across the border in North Dakota, then we would look at first the jurisdiction of incorporation for your U.S. company. That is after we consult with you, Rocky, and determine what the U.S. structure will be for that entity or entities. So I think what you need to know is what they've got going on in Canada, who the owners are, what their corporate structure is in Canada, and then how we can incorporate for them to expand into the U.S. One of the common misconceptions that many, many people come to us with, they'll say, I want an LLC. So I'll immediately stop them there and say, LLCs are treated like flow-through vehicles for tax purposes. They're not taxed in the entity itself, and you could be exposing yourself to a lot of problems. So let's get with a good U.S. CPA. Let's talk about the correct structure for you, and then we'll talk about jurisdiction. So in terms of jurisdiction, our preferred jurisdictions are Delaware or Nevada, generally. Delaware, why? Well, Delaware has a very robust set of corporate laws that are well understood and are not unpredictable. So, you know, corporation-friendly body of laws is one reason why you'd go to Delaware. Another reason you'd go to Delaware is they have a court of chancery, which is a court that has a high degree of expertise with corporate law in itself. But I've learned from you that Delaware may not be a tax ideal jurisdiction because it has franchise tax legislation. So we then look at Nevada. And I think since we've started working with you, we've started to incorporate more and more Nevada corporations and fewer Delaware corporations.
Yep. Yeah, sorry. Yeah, go ahead, Matt.
And in Nevada, generally, you know, my understanding after reading the corporate law of Nevada is that very business friendly. There is no income tax if you're not doing business in Nevada. And the only sort of one cost consideration is that you have to maintain a business license in Nevada, which is an additional $500 US a year, but no franchise tax legislation. So, you know, your likelihood of having to pay corporate tax is lower. One other thing about Nevada, and I've been doing some reading about sort of director liability, is that it appears that the courts in Nevada have imposed a lower threshold of liability on corporate directors. So, you know, if you're a director of a Delaware corporation versus a Nevada corporation, you may have a lower standard for discharging duties as a director to act in the best interests of the corporation and its shareholders.
Yeah, that's very interesting, Vance. And, we've done a number of these and, I'll make up a number here. I'll say 90% of multinationals, global multinationals incorporate in Delaware. So it's for all the reasons you mentioned. However, I generally have a distrust in governments. I have a distrust in auditing agencies of various governmental entities. And when I say distrust, it just means that they're more aggressive in interpreting their own legislation very aggressively, and sometimes contrary to their intent, and sometimes on a retroactive basis. So with that is that I just always want to ensure our clients are protected, and I always treat our clients as if I was doing business myself in that situation, and saying and thinking, what would I want to be advised to do? So as you noted, Delaware does actually have two taxing regimes. One is the state corporate tax, and the other one is the franchise tax. Now, the corporate tax is administered by the Department of Taxation, and the franchise tax is administered by the Secretary of State. So, you know, there, if you don't set up your share structures properly, you could be on, surprisingly, if you have a great number of shares outstanding, even if it's to one shareholder, you can have a substantial liability if you don't kind of manage the number of shares being issued. So that's a franchise tax. And the corporate income tax only applies if you have nexus within the state. Maintaining a statutory address or a business address through a registered agent by Delaware law does not constitute nexus. So you can have a Delaware holding company. So you can have a Canadian company own a Delaware holding company and then own another company that's actually operational. And we've actually had that situation where the operational entity was sold at a sizable gain with an eight-figure capital gain. And essentially, it didn't. The state income tax in Delaware did not apply because all they maintained there was a statutory address. But it just scares me that the fact there is a taxing regime. And can that change? Can that be interpreted? We're seeing increasingly now that, you know, sometimes old archaic laws are being dug up to achieve a certain objective. And so sometimes what happened in the past may not happen in the future. So Delaware has given no indication it's not abiding by its historical kind of stance that you are not subject to state corporate tax as long as you don't have nexus. But that's not to say it cannot change. Now, you mentioned Nevada. Nevada does not have a income tax. So the whole legislation does not exist at this moment. They do have what is known as a commerce tax, but that's only if you have in-state Nevada-based customers and you're selling, you know, greater than $4 million worth of goods or services. So Nevada is a little bit more, I would say, if I want to use the word safer, from a corporate income tax perspective, because they do not have the franchise tax, they do not have a corporate income tax. And therefore, there's no kind of ability for an auditor to be somewhat aggressive because the statute doesn't even exist. Having said all that, you know, I'm based in Toronto, you're based in the West Coast, and I've seen that, you know, our East Coast customers generally look at Delaware, and our West Coast customers look at Nevada because that's where they feel more comfortable. But, you know, all the ones I think we've worked on have been Nevada based for the reasons. And that's interesting. You noted about the director liability. You know, that's another favorable kind of, jurisprudence that makes Nevada a bit safer, a bit more kind of business friendly as well. Now, what about Wyoming? We talked about Wyoming a little bit. Do you want to talk about that? It also, similar to Nevada, it doesn't have a corporate income tax, but I think the infrastructure might be a little bit hard to come by. Can you talk about Wyoming a bit?
Yes, Rocky. So Wyoming, one of the things that we should also talk about and that we consider and advise our clients on when we're choosing a jurisdiction for incorporation is basically privacy and whether you have to disclose who the directors and officers of the company is. And that varies state to state. So in Wyoming, the Secretary of State allows companies to appoint nominee officers and directors. So you can have somebody who's with the agent company for your corporation in Wyoming that could be director or officer. It also is more difficult to, you can register a corp operation, and its directors and officers may not be disclosed in a search in Wyoming. So privacy is quite valuable, particularly in this day and age. And I think that that's another thing that you'll find in Texas as well, comparable to Wyoming, is it's very difficult to get information from the public record about Texas corporations. And in my experience, that's similar in Wyoming. The experience that we've had with Wyoming, notwithstanding the tax advantages, and we have a number of clients that come to us and other CPAs that recommend Wyoming for tax reasons. But we have found that when you're dealing with corporations through the Secretary of State in Wyoming, that the system is not very user-friendly. It's certainly not as automated and fast as Delaware, Nevada, or some other states. And, we were talking about this, you and I, and you said, well, the population of Wyoming is much smaller and their infrastructure is much smaller. And so that may be why. But we just found that if you have a time-sensitive matter and you're trying to get something done like a corporate reorganization through the Secretary of State in Wyoming, you're at the mercy of the clerks that work in the Secretary of State office, and you might have to have something hand-delivered, and they might not accept electronic signatures, for example. You might not be able to do filings on an expedited basis. So there are some challenges there.
Yeah, exactly. And, that secrecy, if we want to use that word, for Wyoming and maybe even Texas, that can work both ways as well. I've been involved in an incident where, you actually needed to prove out ownership. There was a competing interest in an LLC or a corporation, and it was difficult to prove it out. Two parties were trying to prove out the same ownership of the same corporation, and without state registered records on file there, it all came down to whatever individual shareholders had with at their disposal and agreements, and some of it was verbal even. So it can become problematic the other way as well. And you mentioned Texas. I haven't personally been involved in setting up any Texas corporations, but that would trigger Nexus from a Texas franchise point of view. But that doesn't mean any additional tax. It just depends. That depends on the operations. And Texas, the state of Texas as well, does require a public information report to be filed along with the returns. So, but that might be just kept closely held at the state. That public information report requires a disclosure of the officers and the directors. So a bit more work there in Texas from a corporate point of, from a tax point of view. Let's move on now. And we talked a little bit about, you mentioned earlier on about the LLCs. If I had a dollar every time somebody Googled something and, and they say, well, I was recommended from my U.S. friend to open up an LLC or an S corp. And, anything else you recommend is ridiculous because you're making me subject to double taxation. And you just hit the nail on the head, Vance. And that's why I find that both your services and my services of U.S. services in Canada, we see both sides of the border. And just because something works from a U.S. domestic point of view, soon as you have some sort of cross-border ownership or activity, can make that strategy not work. So an LLC is a prime example. It can lead to double taxation because the Canada Revenue Agency does not recognize the flow-through treatment of an LLC and therefore creates timing issues for foreign tax credits and the operations of the business as well. So we have found ways to accommodate cross-border structures and also ownerships from a Canadian and U.S. point of view, which involves the use of LPs. But, that is a very sophisticated strategy that it can accomplish the same things as an LLC. Would you agree from a legal liability point of view?
Yes. And I mean, we are familiar with an incorporated, organized, register limited partnership structures, and it's always based on the tax advisor saying this is an optimal structure. And so we have, in fact, just done that in Texas. So we've just created a limited partnership structure in Texas with limited partners in Canada and in Texas. So when the tax advisor says limited partnership is the correct structure, and that will allow flow through to the limited partners and they'll be taxed there, then we can certainly register those limited partnership structures, and we set them up with, you know, you have a limited partnership, you have limited partners, a general partner, and usually you have a limited partnership agreement. So for an LLC, you typically have an operating agreement, which is similar. For a corporation, you have a shareholder agreement. And for a limited partnership, you have a limited partnership agreement.
Right, right. And we did a couple of those as well. Because the investment was coming from both a U.S. shareholder and a Canadian-based shareholder as well. So, you know, we accomplished the same benefits of having a domestic LLC situation, but also making sure it was tax efficient, both on the U.S. side for the American shareholder and on the U.S.-Canadian side for the Canadian shareholders as well. So let's kind of move forward now. So, you know, we got a Canadian corporation. They set up either a Delaware or a Nevada corporation for their U.S. operations. What's next, Vance? What else do they need to do now and look out for as they start to embark on getting that U.S. corporation fully functioning and now operating in the United States?
Well, Rocky, once you've got your tax advice, and once we've got the instructions that have incorporated and organized your corporation, you'll want to get started doing business. And one of the key things to enable you to do that is to register with the IRS and file a form SS4 and get an employer identification number. Employer identification number is basically a tax ID for the corporation. And, you know, we'll want to either have Baker Tilly do that, or under the advisement of Baker Tilly, we can file the form. And then that we can prepare a package of corporate documents with the EIN and send it to you as the owner of the corporation that you can walk into a bank with and open a U.S. bank account. And that's really one of the practical, very important things that can be for a Canadian owner of a corporation when you want to sort of get started. You want to get a U.S. bank account open so you can start having your sales revenue flow into that bank account. So, you know, that's it. It's really getting you incorporated, organized, getting an EIN, working with your tax advisor to make sure you're compliant for sales tax in any jurisdiction where you're doing business. And then, of course, there are other things like if you're going to open an office or set up a distribution hub, we can assist you with that. If you have personnel and you need employment agreements or independent contractor agreements, we can help you with that. And then there is the U.S. Corporate Transparency Act and the filing of a beneficial ownership information report. So this is under the Financial Crimes Enforcement Network, or FinCEN. And that is the agency that enforces the Corporate Transparency Act, which came out on January 1st, 2024. So basically, if you're a U.S. corporation, you have to file one of these reports that says who the beneficial owners are. And if you have Canadian owners in that corporation, we have to get information from them right down to their passports. And then we have to have one of those people be a company applicant. And then we disclose who the owners of the corporation are. And there are deadlines to file a beneficial ownership information report for your corporation. And those are basically in flux. The U.S. government has put it on, taken it off, put it on. There's been some litigation around it. And so currently it's on. But what we're doing is we are simply taking a conservative approach for our clients and filing those reports timely.
Yeah, and I've seen that. And it's almost been going back and forth, it feels like, on a daily basis since December. I've been watching the updates, but I like that approach that, you know, if in doubt, file, right? Mm-hmm. So at least, you know, you're taking that conservative approach unless you feel there is an issue on filing and the disclosure of that information, then I don't think that conservative approach should hurt at all.
And one of the things to keep in mind about beneficial ownership information report is there are penalties that are associated with non-filing and non-compliance. And so we're definitely advising our clients that they don't want to be in a penalty situation for not filing. And there are another thing that is important to understand about this is that there are certain exemptions from the requirement to file that are based on the facts surrounding your business and your corporation. And so we will review those that list of exemptions with you as a client, and you'll have to determine factually whether you apply for and want to claim one of the exemptions. So it's interesting, since this has come into being in January 1st, 2024, what we've observed is that most, if not all, good accounting firms will not file these reports. And that is because it's considered to be the practice of law. And we've also noticed that some, in fact, many, even US law firms won't touch advising or filing these reports on behalf of their clients. We have taken an approach where we're willing to work with the clients for whom we act as registered and records office to prepare and file the reports based on the information they provide. So we're cautious, but we are providing this service. And I'll just say to your listeners, Rocky, that if you get an accounting firm that willy-nilly wants to file one of these reports, that they're probably engaging in the unauthorized practice of law, and they may or may not be doing it correctly. So you want to be careful about that, and you want to have a qualified U.S. attorney assisting you with beneficial ownership reports under the Corporate Transparency Act.
Yeah, no, you're exactly right. And we at Baker Tilly have taken that position. It is a practice of law because it's under the Corporate Transparency Act and not the Internal Revenue Code. So we've definitely taken that position that it should be handled by legal counsel in the U.S. So now we figured out the state, we've registered, we've done the BOI, you have a registered agent. Maybe an office or everything's been set up, a distribution warehouse or something of that nature. What about sales tax?
Well, that's a really interesting one, Rocky, because, again, we don't do tax, thank goodness. So it's back to you. And sales tax is one where, as a lawyer, I can advise on whether you've established a presence in a particular state such that you'd need to register your corporation with the Secretary of State. And that's usually if you've got an office there, if you have employees, and you may or may not be required to run payroll, submit payroll tax. That's another question. But sales tax, what if you set up in Nevada and you've got a warehouse there, or not even a presence because you're just simply distributing your product through shipping methods? Where are you required to pay sales tax? You could be required, if you're selling into multiple jurisdictions, required to register for and pay sales tax in those jurisdictions. We just ask the accountants to help with that.
Yeah, that's where we kind of work together, and you need both of us to kind of help out, because we don't do the actual registration because it's done with the Secretary of State, which is more of a legal function. But once you register for sales tax, we definitely help with the compliance and the consulting, whether on what to collect, how much to collect, and how much to remit. And just as you mentioned, just because you're incorporated in Nevada and you have a distribution warehouse, let's say there, does not exempt you from taxation in other states. That is based on that nexus requirement. And most states now, due to a court case in 2019 under Wayfair, has a very low threshold. So you're required to generally register for sales tax if you have over $100,000 of income coming from that state. So it requires you to register. And what's really sometimes unfortunate, people are not aware. And at the end of the day, this is not your liability. So, if you're non-compliant for a year, 2 years, 3 years, and you're selling into a state and you're required to remit sales tax, well, you could have collected that from the customer. So it's an in and an out. You are just a mechanism, withholding agent, so to speak, to collect this tax and remit it to the government. And we've seen an unfortunate incidences that some of our clients that come to us are not aware of this requirement, and they've been caught by the auditors. And they said, well, you should have been collecting from customers and withholding. So the state auditors or the taxing divisions will put their hands around anyone's neck they can get a hold of. So if they get a hold of a client that has not been compliant, and even though it's not their liability, it's unfortunately joint and several liability, they can go after either the customer or the withholding agent. And so we've seen circumstances where, companies have had to pay sales tax on liabilities that was not theirs to begin with. So it's better to get the right advice. It's better to engage with, you know, your tax accountant and your U.S. legal counsel to ensure that you're compliant going forward day one. Well, you know, Vance, I think we've covered off quite a bit here. And, you know, in today's environment, maybe just, you know, I don't think our podcast would be complete without kind of talking about, you know, the latest on tariffs and what's going here. Now, we're not tariff experts, customs and duties experts. Well, what are some of the changes or things that companies need to be careful of, either from an immigration point of view as well with the new administration? Any last thoughts on kind of what you're seeing that's new or emerging and that people need to be aware of?
Well, clearly, Rocky, we act for many, many Canadian companies that are manufacturing products like equipment in Canada and selling it across the border into the United States. So they're going to be impacted dramatically by the tariffs. And what we are doing with many of them is they're really looking hard at what President Trump wanted, which was to set up their manufacturing facilities in the United States. And so that may, in fact, be efficient for them. It may, you know, depends on where they're located in Canada, where their market is in the United States, and whether, you know, it's more expensive for them to be manufacturing in the United States or not. But that's one of the things that we have a number of clients that are looking hard at is avoiding tariffs by setting up their manufacturing facilities in the United States. We have done some research. We had an interesting question just last week about a business that was asking whether if they were owned by Indigenous people, and if they were selling to a customer in the United States that was Indigenous owned, whether they would be exempt from tariffs. And we did the research and found that, in fact, they would not. So the Jay Treaty of 1794 between Britain and the United States does provide for mobility of Indigenous people from Canada to the United States without having to get a work permit. And they can even get a U.S. green card or permanent residence in quite straightforward manner. However, if they own a business and they're selling into the U.S., that's not going to be exempt from tariffs. So number one is, you know, we're seeing a lot of clients look at moving their manufacturing facilities into the United States. On the immigration side, I'll just say that even before President Trump was elected, like since November, we started to see many, many different types of refusals for non-immigrant or work visas to the United States. So very topical for us is the Canadian woman who's in the news in the news now about applying for a TN visa at the southern border into the United States, being told that her paperwork was not approved, but she didn't do anything wrong to apply. And she was detained for 12 days without access to information or anything else, you know, apparently in not good conditions. So we have seen refusals, and we are filing U.S. non-immigrant and immigrant visas, you know, several a week. And so we've seen refusals in E2 treaty investor visa applications at the U.S. consulate in Toronto. We've seen what we would consider fairly straightforward intercompany transferee visa applications or L visa applications at ports of entry. And we've also seen TN visas where a person has had a history of having a TN trade NAFTA visa, applying again the same manner with a very good package and being denied, having their existing visa canceled and having their nexus canceled. So overall, we've seen a lot more refusals, a lot less flexibility or facilitation under the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement. And, you know, we're sort of being extra vigilant in representing our clients with respect to U.S. visa applications now. It's kind of tough times.
Yeah, it is. It's the TN visa almost, and from my experience, has been almost like the easiest, right? That's like the no-brainer, right? You hit the occupation category, you get a job letter and, you know, stamp your alum, you go, right? And that seems like that's no longer the case and it's being more scrutinized.
Well, it's very straightforward if you're an accountant or an engineer, but if you're a scientific technician working in support of an engineer, or if you're a management consultant, doing something that is may very well be what a management consultant is and does, which is come into a corporation and review a process and give a report and some recommendations, and maybe to a lesser extent, facilitate them in implementing those recommendations. So that's a supernumerary or external party coming into an organization and providing some expert services. They don't like TN management consultant visa applications at all, and they like to deny them. They think that that's one where everybody's just trying to fit in to a nebulous category. And so it's very hard to get them now.
Right, right. Okay. So I guess you need a professional more than ever.
Yeah, absolutely. You need somebody who's got very deep experience in this area. And, you know, as a plug for Langford Law's Business Immigration Group, we have a group of attorneys and paralegals with many, many years of experience, both in non-immigrant or work visas, as well as immigrant or green cards. And, you know, you need to have expert counsel in these applications, because if you, in particular, go to a land border, the culture there is different, and they may not only refuse your application, they may also enforce a bar or impose a bar on admission to the United States that could range from 1 year to life.
Right, right. And if, is that generally based on a perceived misrepresentation on an application? Is that
usually yes? Or if, for example, it may or may not be misrepresentation on the application, but if they feel that you are doing something that you shouldn't have been, so you're working in the U.S. in a category that you weren't authorized to do, that would be the reason for a bar. Look, you've gone, you've violated the law. You're trying again. You're trying to legitimize it. So we're going to bar you.
Understood. Understood. Okay. All right. Well, Vance, I really appreciate, you taking time to for this episode at for Opportunity Rocks. This is invaluable information. I can't imagine, a better place to come to get this type of information. So really appreciate that. This expertise, once again, I think that we both have, and, just kind of plugging it both firms is, it's invaluable. And the main thing is getting the right information at the right time so that everyone can make the right moves in these uncertain times. And while there's no exact certainties, by taking the necessary precautions, you can minimize any negative impact and achieve the business and individual objectives that you seek out for your company and yourself as well. So that's it. Another episode of Opportunity Rocks. Thank you, Vance, for being our guest, and we'll see you at the next episode.
It's my pleasure, Rocky. Thank you. You do rock.
Thank you for tuning in to Opportunity Rocks, hosted by Rocky Bhatia. We hope today's episode provided valuable insights to help you navigate and succeed in the world of business. Make sure to subscribe so you don't miss future conversations with more industry experts, because you never know when a great opportunity rocks next.